I'm going to tell you about an experiment that's recently been conducted in Trento in Italy. And I've chosen a rather controversial title. I'm expecting some tough questioning. I think I'm up for it today. This is an experimental result. I'm not an experimentalist, so I may falter at some points trying to explain some of the finer details. My contribution, along with Tom's, was the analysis of the instantons in this model. First of all, about what the experiment claims to see, I'll tell you about the observations, and then I'll tell you ways in which this work might be extended to two or more dimensions. This is trying to look for vacuum decay, Coleman's original work on vacuum decay was describing the decay in quantum field theory from one state to another through the emergence of bubbles driven by vacuum fluctuations. However, somewhat later, André Lindy introduced the concept of vacuum decay at finite temperature, and you might notice, of course, that's an internal contradiction. So this is a situation where you have a state that decays through fluctuations, through thermal fluctuations, but it's still describable in terms of what we call an instanton. And the experiment I'm going to talk about is this first one. It's the vacuum decay at finite temperature. You may be a little bit disappointed by this, but in the early universe, where we think there are applications of false vacuum decay, you may have both. For example, the zero temperature one may be of interest in inflation, whereas the finite temperature one could occur possibly at the electroweak phase transition. So both of these are interesting in the early universe. I want to say a little bit about an important question about just how relativistic our analog system is going to be. A BEC, of course, is a non-relativistic system. So we've got to look within this BEC for some fluctuation of the false vacuum, which is described by a relativistic dispersion relation. This will only be approximate, and in particular, it's usually at large wavelengths, as Alex described earlier. The existence of a relativistic mode, though, is not enough for a relativistic decay, because the bubbles, when they form, first of all, they are large fluctuations. So we want the bubble to behave in a relativistic way to grow like the bubbles in Coleman's original analysis. Now, the problem is when a bubble grows, the wall moves at close to the speed of light, or sound in this case, and suffers Lorentz contraction. So it becomes thinner and thinner. And so if our dispersion relation is not valid at large k, at small wavelengths, then at some point the bubble will stop growing relativistically and will undergo non-relativistic behavior. And typically what's observed is that the bubble slows down and can even start to recollapse again. Now, in the models that we heard about earlier today from Alex and Kate, there's a tunable parameter that you can use to extend this relativistic growth. In the model I'm going to talk about now, there isn't such a parameter. It seems that we get some relativistic growth in 1D, but far less in 2D. So that's the background. So now let me go on to what's actually seen. So the system in Trento is a cigar-shaped Bose-Einstein condensation of sodium atoms. We focus on two hyperfine levels in the sodium. We mix these levels, or they mix these levels, with a radio frequency beam, and that introduces two free parameters. One is related to the amplitude of the beam, and we call this the Rabi frequency, and one is related to the detuning between the frequency of the RF beam and the energy split between these levels. We call that the detuning. So these are tunable parameters. We also have some parameters that relate to the collisions between these states, and that this gives us three numbers which are fixed. A feature of this system is that a particular combination of these collision parameters, which we call kappa, is negative. And in this situation, the system has ferromagnetic ground states. That means the system finds ground states in which all the atoms are in the up state or all the atoms are in the down state. So this is a special feature of this particular system, but it's also realized in some other systems as well. So this is different. In some of the models you heard about earlier, the ground state is a sort of superposition of up and down. In these systems, the ground state is up or down. So here are the observations. These are what the experimentalists actually see. At the top there, you see the cigar shape is placed vertically, and the time is horizontal. As you see, the cigar is about 200 microns long, and this is 7 different runs. So in each thin strip within the thicker strip is a single run, and this is sort of 15 milliseconds, 7 runs, 7 times, however many strips there are. The experiment's actually been run up to 150 milliseconds. So these are just the early ones, but there are bubbles that occur more than 100 milliseconds in from the beginning of the experiment. So the bottom indicates how the experiment's run. So initially, the system is placed into an up state, a stable up state. Then one of the parameters, in fact the G-tuning, is changed so that up state becomes a metastable state. And we call that T equals zero. After a while, a bubble will nucleate from this metastable state. We don't see that because we don't see anything until an observation is made at a later time. And at the later time, the width of the bubble is measured. So you don't actually see where the bubble nucleates. You just see the width of the bubble at a particular time. Of course, if there's no bubbles nucleated, you will see no width. You just see the blue, which indicates the up state. Fortunately, this system can be described by quite a simple one-dimensional model. The system is quite thick. It's not a one-dimensional condensate. Fortunately, the parameter of interest, which is the magnetization, the amount of up versus down states, is uniform over the transverse dimension. So we can just integrate out the density in the transverse dimension and get an effective one-dimensional theory for the magnetization. And when we find this effective theory for the magnetization, there are, the potential is given there, and the picture in red there is a picture of the potential for the magnetization. So we have 2 tunable parameters. Remember, the omega and the delta, the Rabi frequency, the detuning, are tunable. They're defined on this radio frequency mixing. And there's one parameter there that depends on the scatterings, which is not tunable, although there's some dependence there on x from the density that appears. So by choosing these parameters, we can arrange that the potential here has a false vacuum minimum and a true vacuum minimum. Due to the x dependence of the first term in the potential, though, it means that as we go to the low-density regime near the edges of the cigar shape, the metastable state becomes stable again. So we don't have metastability in the middle 120 microns or so of the cigar shape. This picture also shows the experimental protocol. The gray indicates the initial state where the detuning is chosen so that the up state is on the left. The up state is the global minimum. And then the detuning is ramped down to negative values where the up state becomes a metastable state. So the system is placed in a metastable state. So we've analyzed this model in various ways. Our emphasis has been on the false vacuum decay rate. The system is actually quite hot. If you ask what is the temperature at which this would be a purely vacuum transition, it would be around about 40 nanokelvin or so. And the system is much hotter than that. It's much closer to, hundreds of nanokelvin or even a microkelvin. So the decay process here is false vacuum decay at finite temperature. The rate for this process involves what you might think of as a thermal instanton, that is an instanton that just depends on position. And the decay rate depends exponentially on the energy of this instanton solution. So the energy has gradient terms and potential terms. So you have to find this instanton solution, substitute it into the energy, and that enables us to calculate the rate. Now, the calculation has to be done numerically. However, there's a good approximation in the case where the barrier here is small, like shown in the picture there. There is a critical value of the detuning at which the barrier goes away. That's quite an important point. So let's say delta crit is the value of the detuning at which there's no potential barrier. And the energy of the instanton depends sensitively on the difference between the detuning and the critical value of the detuning, and is has a weaker dependence on parameters like the Rabi frequency there. Before I compare this instanton decay rate to the experiment, I'd just like to show another way of analyzing this experiment, and that's in terms of the stochastic projected Gross-Pitevsky equation. So for this, we use the same code. We use Kate Brown's code, which solves the Gross-Pitevsky equation with damping and a noise term. At finite temperature, the correlation function of the noise is just determined by the temperature and the damping. In this numerical simulation of the experiment, you can actually measure the time at which the bubble appears. However, you can't measure the time at which the bubble appears in the experiment. Instead, you can measure a quantity called the vacuum fraction, which is take a given time and ask how much of the system is in the false vacuum. We call that the vacuum fraction at time t. And that you can measure in the experiment, is measured in the experiment. The figure on the right here, and it doesn't look very exciting, but that is quite important. The figure on the right shows a vacuum fraction. It shows a vacuum fraction that arises from the stochastic Gross-Pitevsky simulation that's in red. The red dots show the simulation, and the red lines show the variance, the error. And the black line, if you can see that in the middle, is an idealized analytic approximation of a system that nucleates bubbles at random, which then grow. And that is possible to actually look out an analytic formula for the vacuum fraction in that idealized situation. The agreement is so spot on that shows that the stochastic Gross-Pitevsky equation is producing bubbles. Well, you can actually see them at the top, but actually the numerics tell us that it's producing bubbles that grow. There's some funny features. You might notice that the bubbles grow at the speed of sound. The speed of sound varies as you go along the x direction of the condensate. So the light blue here is the upstate, and pink is the downstate. So that's a numerical run, which you see has two bubbles, if you can make it out from the distance. First.
What are the lines on your
graph? The top graph or the bottom graph?
Bottom one.
So what are the lines on the graph? So the black line is an analytic formula for a very idealized situation where you nucleate bubbles, you nucleate bubbles, straight bubbles, in one dimension, and then these bubbles grow. So the bubbles nucleate, and then they grow. So there's no there's no Gross-Pitevsky equation behind that. Just imagine a very simple simulation where you just nucleate bubbles and you let them grow at a constant rate. The black line is that analytic formula for the fraction of the system in the false vacuum at time t. So it's an analytic formula that describes the nucleation of bubbles, idealized bubbles. Okay, so it shows So the end bit of that black line is an exponential decay law. And in fact, that's exactly the same as the one we saw in Alex's talk, I think, that exponential decay. At the top, you get this little bit of a shoulder. I think we saw a bit of a shoulder in Alex's pictures as well. And you're saying there's an analytic formula that actually describes all this in an idealized situation. Now, the red dots come from the stochastic Gross-Pietrzewski equation. So what I did there was, imagine you take time 30 milliseconds, and I draw, okay, what I didn't say here is the data here is just taken from the central 20 microns, because that's roughly homogeneous, and the theory applies to a homogeneous system. So the central 20 microns of this system are pretty homogeneous. The trap that's applied has very little effect on the central 20 microns. So you take that. So imagine, take the central 20 microns at time 20, calculate the fraction of that that's pink as opposed to blue, and that is the F. So I've done that over lots and lots of runs for some particular set of parameters, and that's the red dot. And of course, you do that for many runs, and obviously there's some statistical variation. So the two red lines are the average plus the standard error and the average minus the standard error.
And there's black lines you have, so the random bubbles. Do you have any correlation between them?
No. Oh, no. That's something we'd like to learn about. So this is this is a very good question. If I took the last 25 milliseconds and blew up the scale, you would see there's a discrepancy between the two pictures. I think this is a departure from idealized bubble nucleation. But I don't think it's correlation. I think it's bubbles nucleating on bubbles. And, Tom's going to, student's going to do that, I think, soon. So actually, yeah, there is some discrepancy at the very end of this picture, which is interesting. Yeah. Thanks for asking. So how does this agree with the experiment? Here's two sets of data. We have four sets of data that agree quite well. I prefer the smaller omegas because they have more relativistic type behavior. So the dots are the data without the experiment and data without error bars, because the error bars are so big. They clutch up the diagram. The little dots with error bars are the stochastic Gross-Pietrzewski equation, and the line is an instanton fit. This is a two-parameter instanton fit. If you look at the formula at the bottom, there's dependence on the temperature. So one parameter is the temperature. The other parameter is the prefactor. Now, the exponential law for the decay rate has a prefactor in it, and it's a horrendous thing to calculate, so we don't calculate it, we just fit it. So the line is a two-parameter fit to the data using the instanton formula. In the stochastic Gross-Pietrzewski equation, what we've done is we've taken the temperature from the instanton fit, and that doesn't give us any free parameters. So the second one is sort of, there's a caveat to that, I'll tell you the caveat in a moment. The stochastic Gross-Pietrzewski equation has no free parameters. It has one, but it sort of has no free parameters if you use the same temperature from the instanton fit. Now, you notice that the stochastic Gross-Pietrewski equation reasonably close to the instanton line at large. The vertical axis is the decay time, which is log 2 over the decay rate. Now, you'll see that for larger decay times, the instanton and the stochastic Gross-Pietrewski equation are quite close. But as you go to smaller decay times, they depart. And we expect that because the instanton formula only applies when the exponent in the instanton formula is bigger than 1. Really, it should be much bigger than 1. But We know in practice it tends to be just bigger than one does. So so the stochastic Gross-Pitevsky equation allows us to extend the results right down to zero times. These are all the data, but if I'm being entirely honest, at very high rates, there are some times when the bubbles nucleate before the ramping stage is finished, and so they have negative times. And of course, the log scale cuts those off. So, So we can't. So we've kept all the data for positive times here. So the experimental error bars are in the paper. Yeah, they are comparable to the, well, they're all comparable. If you put them on the red dots, they are all consistent with the scatter. The blue dots at 300, seem to be something of a lucky. What I can say is that the red dots were actually taken in the first experiments. I think the blue ones are a bit later, but the paper has four sets of data.
In the solid line,
is it instanton fit? So the instanton fit has two parameters: the one due to the prefactor, and one the temperature.
But the solid line.
The solid line. That's right. Is the instanton.
The error bars from the stochastic Gross-Pitevsky.
And the ones with error bars are from the stochastic Gross-Pitevsky equation. We found this actually in thermal simulations that the instanton and the stochastic Gross-Pitevsky equation are in very good agreement for the finite temperature results. We have done truncated Wigner, like Alex has, and we've struggled to get agreement between, well, we've not got agreement between the truncated Wigner and the instanton, but we all think that's something to do with renormalization. I think that's fair enough. Hi.
What's his T?
So that's log 2 divided by the decay rate.
Decay rate
of what?
So what is what if I have experimental things? So what is how do you get what is this T50? Is this when 50% of the area is filled or what is it?
Yeah, let me go back. Yeah, that's why it was called tau 50. I'm afraid I plotted these when we still had tau 50. In the paper, we don't use tau 50. So we can measure the mean nucleation time tau. So that's not quite the same as the time at which half have decayed. But we have, I think there's a log 2 between them. So there's a gray line here, which you can barely see, which I didn't mention. In the paper, I've used an analytic formula for an idealized bubble nucleation situation. The experimentalists pick their own formula for fitting this curve, and it's different from the analytic formula. And that's the gray curve there. But once you have that curve, you can then read off from that what the decay rate should be. So in the paper, a different way is used for extracting the decay rate than what we've done here, but they are shown to be consistent in the paper.
You take very many experiments, yeah. And then you try to get that histogram, which is this F
over T. That's right. There are examples of that histogram in the paper. That's right.
Yeah. Ian, can I ask a couple of follow-up questions? So when you were talking about the very homogeneous bit, which is, I think you said it was 20
nanometers? Right, 20. Yeah.
From the previous plot you showed where you showed multiple realizations, it looked like they were basically exactly the same location they were nucleating from. Do you have any plot showing that actually it's nucleating randomly within the 20 nanometers that you say is homogeneous?
Yeah, the trouble is that 20 microns or so is very difficult to resolve. So I don't know of any case where they actually when the bubble first appears, the bubble radius is way below the resolution that's available in the experiment. So you don't catch the bubbles actually nucleating. They've always grown a little bit by the time we catch them here. So you don't see the initial scatter of the position. And
so how can you actually be sure that they're not seeded by some very inhomogeneous setting here?
Very inhomogeneous. Like I said, it's the fit to the instanton that we're using here, because we don't have data on where they actually nucleate. Mm. They tend to nucleate closer to the center because that's a feature of the X dependence of the trap. It would be much better if they had better resolution. One thing, well, you can look at some of these and think, well, maybe there are two bubbles, two red stripes. I suspect the experimentalists would be rather cross at me if I suggested that was two bubbles. Yeah.
If I may then ask about the instanton fit, I mean, you've got two free parameters there, right?
Yeah.
And are they the same free parameters for, like, I mean, how you can fit many things with two parameters.
Yeah.
So in what sense does the theory match the experiment?
That's a good question. In fact, that's going to be one of the caveats on a later slide. If you take two adjacent omegas like this one, the parameters are consistent within the errors.
Okay.
But as we go all the way from, well, we actually go from 200 to 800, there's a systematic drift in the parameters, which we don't understand. So so any two of them, their parameters are similar. But I think between the first and the last one, there's a factor of two or so.
Right.
Now,
and are you also saying that the stochastic GPE does not need renormalization? Did I understand you correctly?
Yes, it does need. Okay. There is one. I lied. But I said there are no free parameters. There is one. Free parameter, the delta crit there, because you can work out what that should be from the underlying potential. We have to shift it. So there is one change. That is on the next slide, so it's not so dishonest. So delta crit. Now, however, if you look at the Hamiltonian, you see there's coupling between the magnetization and the other modes. And they are in just the right place to shift delta crit. Now, the thing about this is that when you do the stochastic Gross-Piotrowski equation, it has all the modes in. So it does this shift for you, in a sense. So in other words, the delta crit that comes out of the stochastic Gross-Piotrowski equation is not the one you put in into the Burr theory, as it were. It includes the thermal corrections to delta crit. So that's the one. So that's the only parameter that we had to adjust. It is on the next slide. I just wanted to, it's the same question that Tiranya just asked. Ideally, every one of these should come up with the same temperature. Okay, so how do I fix the temperature? The experimentalists claim they have good control of the temperature, and there is consistency within a given run. Within two neighboring runs, they're close enough, within the errors. But there is a systematic drift. So the omega equals 800 hertz, the Rabi frequency is 800, is something like twice the temperature of the 200 hertz.
Yeah, but I'm even thinking maybe not thermal, right? And that will affect the rate because it's exponentially sensitive to the distribution.
So can you say that again? It sounds interesting.
Well, if it's not completely thermalized, the transition will be different. The formula, kind of this instanton calculation won't apply, right? It will be a different instanton, right? With different action. Maybe.
Maybe. We've tended to think of this slight drift in the temperature as due to the fact that it's a 1D simulation, and
it's really
a 3D system. And what needs to be done is a 3D simulation just to pin that down. Uh-huh. As far as the thermalization is, that's really an experimental question I'm not qualified to answer. Jonathan, can you do your bit and pick some?
I think the whole system is out of equilibrium, right?
The whole system, we claim it's in local equilibrium, in the false vacuum state. We have done a thermal a thermal instantile calculation on the assumption that that when you do this ramping, it is in thermal equilibrium. Oh, there's something. Because
so
the nice thing about
you have used fluctuation dissipation theorem, right?
So there's something kind of interesting here, because when we do the stochastic Gospodarski equation, we can reproduce what happens in the experiment. So we let the thing in the numerical simulation, we let the system equilibrate in the true vacuum state. We apply the ramp, and then we see the decay. So we can actually see if the system is driven out of thermal equilibrium by the ramp. And within this, you know, with the stochastic Gospodarski equation, that seems to say it's fine. And in fact, the ramp we put in the stochastic Gospodarski equation is shorter than the one they have in the experiment. So the system starts off definitely in thermal equilibrium. A ramp is applied over quite a long period of time, and we claim that the system is still in thermal equilibrium. And all it can do to escape is to produce an instanton bubble.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Quick. Yes, so quick. I just looked up the parameters. So you're basically in, from the microscopic physics, it's a 3D experiment.
That's
because
right.
Your temperature is much, much higher than H bar omega perpendicular.
So
it's probably 100 H bar omega perpendicular. And the chemical potential interaction length is probably 10 times H bar omega perpendicular.
So
but the spin healing length is probably... So for the spin healing length, you're probably one-dimensional. It's not written in there.
That's right. It's one-dimensional for the magnetic healing length. It's three-dimensional for the healing length.
Yes. So, yeah. But when you do the Gospodarski calculations, you calculate the microscopic physics. You put the microscopic physics in there. So you would need to do a 3D Gospodarski equation calculation to really simulate your experiment.
So yes, we would like to do a 3D.
Because you have lots of excitations in the transverse direction.
It's remarkable. Hang on, Doug. It's the same. The two gamma t that appears in the noise correlation is the same in any dimension. So in a sense, it's all included as long as we have the right noise correlation. We have a code as well, but Trento won't. Okay, we're not allowed to use our code, because Trento have their own people. But thank you for the offer to use your code.
Sorry, I have a couple more technical follow-up questions.
I really want to talk about this.
Okay, sorry, very quick. So how many healing lengths is 20 nanometers in this experiment?
Ah, okay. So the experiment, the stochastic Gospodarski equation, I've done it on a grid of 250 healing lengths, and that covers about 100 microns. So can you do the math for me?
I can't do it in my head, but just a quick follow-up.
The central region is many healing lengths.
It's many,
hundreds of healing lengths. Yeah.
Okay, and your renormalization point earlier, can I reinterpret that by saying that the experiment has some cutoff, some UV cutoff, and the GPE is actually got the same cutoff, and that's why you say there's no renormalization? I don't understand otherwise how you say there are all the nodes in there.
I'm just making a phenomenological point that when we do the Gospodarski equation and the instanton calculation with the same parameters. In the past, in all models like this type, we've found very good agreement between the two. This is the first time we've seen a discrepancy in having to shift this delta crit. It does seem a feature of the thermal simulations that they're less plagued by renormalization.
But why? It's related to a cutoff in the experiment, presumably, because otherwise there's no way that the simulation can know about.
I should say that in some of our other Kate simulations, we did change the cutoff. Is that right, Kate? And find robustness. Is that? Yeah. Yeah,
we can pick it up.
Yeah, we have tried.
Let's let Ian go on and we can discuss this later.
I think most of the things on this slide, the summary so far I've just said, we see they're definitely metastable state and we see bubbles, right? You might say they're not, but false vacuum decay, we see bubbles. Nucleation timescales, we have timescales covering two orders of magnitude here, and we get good agreement over those timescales. We get an exponential dependence on parameters. I'm told that it's unheard of to have a theory that fits experiment over two orders of magnitude in atomic physics. Controversial statement. There is excellent agreement with the stochastic Gross-Pietersky equation. The instanton, we just talked about that. There's good agreement with SPG and the instanton decay rate and the experiment, but there are big error bars in the experiment. And then the two things at the bottom, what we just discussed, that I had to shift delta critical and N over T drifts. Worse than that, our temperature is not what the experimentalists say they have. Make of that what you will. We differ by, 50% for marginal agreement, maybe a factor of two, if we actually compare the actual values. Could be just because it's a 1D simulation. But I did want to talk about, I've had enough questions on that. Can I move on to the 2D stuff? Yeah, 2D stuff, I'm quite exciting. So this is fantasies, this is just numerical simulations. Well, what if we were to do this system in two dimensions, and we picked a similar system with potassium 41, because I colleagues like to do potassium 41. So it turns out you can do a similar, I believe you can do a similar system with two Zeeman levels in potassium 41. You have to get rid of one of the hyperfine levels by something I've read about called microwave dressing or something. I have no idea what it is. But you get rid of one of the levels, which leaves you with a two-level system, put in RF mixing, collisions. So this system just happens to have the right the right linear relationship between these collision factors that gives you ferromagnetic bubbles again. So we simulated this system. I couldn't resist putting that thing. the first paper I ever wrote was about bubble collisions. So I'm excited by the idea that we might be able to actually do bubble collisions. So, Alex showed you some bubble collisions earlier. I show some bubble collisions in a ferromagnetic bubble system. We do weird things. If you wait a bit for the interesting stuff. The interesting stuff are these two little dots that are merging coming in from the left. So in this ferromagnetic system, the bubble collisions result in the production of vortices. Comes from a simulation that actually shows some of the phases. So on the left is the magnetization, on the right is the phase of one of the fields. First of all, you see that you get different colors, so different bubbles can have different phases. And I must have to stop it. Sorry, I'm too late. So you see on the left, there's a region is collapsing. And on the right, it doesn't show it very well, but you see there's a lot of phase change around two of these neighboring vortices. So what's happening is you've got a vortex-anti-vortex pair with 2 pi phase change around each of the vortices. Now, these... Tom, what are the... that's the zero density in the in the down state. So it's well known that these spin condensates can have vortices. They're called half quantum vortices. They are seen in I don't know, experiments or theory of for example quantum turbulence. They're called half quantum vortices because in a sort of superfluid picture they have a half quantum of circulation around the vortex. So so this would be the production of vortices from the nucleation of bubbles if this experiment was done. And this is interesting because if we go back, way back to the application of false vacuum decay to the early universe, one of the reasons I think, talking to Alan Guth, he said that a strong motivation in inventing the inflation of the universe was to try and solve the monopole problem. That is, if you thought of a false vacuum decay in the early universe, in a grand unified theory, you'd expect to produce lots of monopoles. So this is now sort of turning full circle. The possibility of producing these defects, just like the production of monopoles in the early universe, from a first-order phase transition. So I think it'd be very exciting to do a two-dimensional vacuum decay simulation. Now, hopefully, we're going to see two-dimensional vacuum simulations along the lines of that Alex talked about earlier. I think Alex produced their main walls. I think the ferromagnetic one produces vortices. I'm not sure that you get vortices in the other one. Thanks, Jonathan. Convenient. So it looks like a duck. It walks like a duck. It waddles like a duck. It does look like a false vacuum decay at finite temperature, I should add. Lots of limitations in this model. We're certainly presenting it as a false vacuum decay. But even if this isn't, I think we are very close now to actually seeing a whole range of vacuum decay phenomena. A zero temperature decay is the real one we want to investigate. But things like bubble collisions, defect formation, seeded decay, production of waves from collisions, all of these things, I think, are within the grasp of forthcoming experiments. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks a lot, Ian. And we had quite a few questions, but we've got time for one or two quick ones. I guess, Alex, you could...
Thanks very much, Ian. In the 2D simulations you showed, the bubbles looked like they were kind of breathing.
Yeah.
Is that the non-relativistic, like, recollapse and then growing again?
So it seems like we don't have a parameter that controls the amount of non-relativistic growth here. So basically, you get what you get. In 1D, it seems to look quite relativistic. In 2D, we believe this is the non-relativistic. So they grow a little bit, and then they start to collapse. When they start to collapse, they're unstable. So there's a real mess there. You're right. I think
with the parameter, like the detuning, that is that just changing basically the height of the barrier that doesn't tell it doesn't change.
It seems that if we reduce the detuning, we get more relativistic behavior. But yeah. We've not got this under. We've not got a good theory yet of what it is that prolongs the amount of relativistic behavior. Whereas we know in your model that it's this parameter I call epsilon. You call nu, is it?
Yeah,
so that's right. You make nu smaller, you get more relativistic behavior.
Yeah, exactly.
We don't know what parameter controls it in this, but it may be that omega.
Okay, thanks. Yeah.
Or you can trap them in the escape room.
Since you've been working on bubbles a while, so maybe you're the right person to ask, when people think about bubbles, are they growing ballistically or diffusively? And do you ever make contact with the condensed matter community who are describing surface growth of defects and things like that? And KPZ physics, KPZ physics?
I don't know the Z physics you're talking about. The Coleman bubbles, they accelerate up to the speed of light. In this case, it would be the speed of sound. So that's very simple behavior. In a thermal system, in the electric phase transition, the bubbles are often, they interact with the surrounding medium and they're slowed down.
So diffusive, we could say, or are they going diffusive. Square root of time, or
No. They seem to be a balance between the pressure that's created by the sort of internal vacuum energy versus the pressure due to matter hitting it on the from the outside. So I think there's a it's like a terminal velocity in that. I think I'm maybe talking nonsense.
Well, then that could certainly be diffusive because terminal resistance in an electric circuit, that's all diffusive, and that's the same as when you're falling.
Yeah, there's a lot of studies on, if you want to look at the literature, this plays an essential role in barogenesis. And so there's a lot of studies on the movement of a wall.
So Brownian motion, those things come into it or not?
No, but our bubbles, the walls of our bubbles are actually quite fuzzy. And that's a new thing. And that's the kind of thing we learn from doing these analog systems. That maybe think of the bubble as a classical thing, of the wall as a classical thing is not right. Maybe that wall is fuzzy. And that will have an effect on things like baryogenesis. You know, if the wall is flickering, you're not going to produce the same baryons as if it's just a classical wall. And all of the, but we'd never have thought of these things if we weren't doing these simulations, and you know, if we weren't thinking about doing experiments.
Thanks. Okay, that's all. I'll give you another hand. Thank you.